Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 191 for April 12, 2013. Superchargers stage a resurgence. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Mr. D.
Shiani, how are you?
Doing pretty good. How about you?
Great.
Done anything super exciting this week?
Drove the Cadillac XTS.
And you liked it?
Wrote about it.
Yeah.
It's almost there. I think ultimately it's limited by its architecture, which is
front-wheel
drive, although I had an all-wheel drive version.
I haven't driven that one yet, all-drive.
But the interior is...
superb.
Superb.
Hey, and we got to say hello to Lindsay Brooke. Hey, from SAE International joining us tonight.
Nice to see you guys.
Hey,
yeah. So what have you done exciting this week? Anything?
Oh, boy. Just writing about technology, getting ready for the SAE Congress coming up.
Next week.
Exactly right. Yep. So,
well, one of the things I thought news-wise that was interesting this week was Eco Motors, which I think the world learned about on this show 3 years ago, 4 years ago.
Two and a half years ago,
because we had Peter Hofbauer, ex-Volkswagen engine designer, who had come up with this really cool, you know, sort of boxer engine.
OPOC
engine, right. Mm-hmm. But anyway, long story short is they just landed a huge contract with a Chinese company to start making these things.
Yeah, I was sorry to hear that.
It's Chinese.
Yeah, I want an American company to jump on that. And I also wanted them to do an indie engine.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
You know.
In a Delta Wing.
Well, Delta Wing or in the current chassis, but it's just disappointing.
Well, they're still working with Navistar.
Yeah,
so
but still, you know.
Yeah, the first time I talked to Runkle about that, I predicted this is not going to be a light-duty vehicle power plant. This is going to be in airport tugs or gen sets, and it looks like, because this Chinese company, I think, is a parts supplier, right?
Right,
it's a,
exactly,
a big component supplier.
Correct.
That it's going to be in those kind of industrial uses, maybe construction machines, that kind of thing.
No, I think you're right.
And you mentioned Akadis. I think Akadis is another OPOC developer, aren't they? There's three companies right now that are into that same, what the Junkers aircraft had, which is what Hofbauer kind of picked up on.
Right.
Akadis, Runkle's company, and I think there's one more.
Huh, okay.
Yeah.
But, yeah, not to confuse that it's a variation of the Eco Motors. It's a total different effort.
Yeah, totally different effort, right. But it is looking at opposed piston technology.
That's right.
Which makes a lot of sense from a bill of materials perspective, from a power density perspective. I give these guys credit.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, in the history of the automobile, we've essentially had three engines, right?
You know,
gasoline, diesel, and Wankel. And the Wankel really never went anywhere from a volume standpoint. I mean, Mazda did the best it could with it, but...
It would be cool if Eco Motors could bring this into, say, light-duty commercial vehicles. Who knows?
Well, you know, the big thing is half the parts, so presumably about half the cost.
Right.
That's the big one. That's what's going to get automakers interested. But remember, when we had Peter Hofbauer here, we said, okay, Peter, let's pretend you're back at Volkswagen and somebody brings you this OPOC design. Would you put your own engine into production? He goes, nah, because they've got billions invested in the engines they've got now. They can't walk away from that investment.
No.
So I thought that was very telling, that the guy who invented the engine said, yeah, if I were at Volkswagen, we probably wouldn't even do it. That's the reality of things. You know? You just got billions into something. It's not going to. And, oh, by the way, I should mention, in I think 2 weeks' time, we're going to have Runkle here talking about the latest developments with Eco Motors. So that's something to be on the lookout for.
The other big news this week was the official beginning of the end of AMG. as Steve Cannon was quoted in the Wall Street Journal saying, we're going to make AMG more approachable, and they're going to do a body treatment and some other and a slight suspension upgrade and a slight power upgrade for around $4,000. And I'm just saying to myself, why are you...
And still call it AMG?
Yes. Ugh. And, what's next? Tape stripes and a rear spoiler? I mean, come on, man. I mean, what are they thinking? I mean, AMG. And you're going to start dumbing it down. You're making it more approachable. No, that's not what enthusiasts want. They want to know they can't afford it. They want it.
Damn.
And they want it to be the ultimate Mercedes. But, you know, they don't want to know that they can get an AMG lookalike.
Oh, I hadn't heard. I missed this completely.
Oh, yeah. I had it on the website.
Oh, my
God. On the table.
That's bad.
It's just like, man, what are you doing?
I'll just say one thing. Mustang 2 King Cobra. That's where that path leads you.
Or all those Shelby versions of Dodge Omnis that were done when Shelby was whoring his name out back then, too.
That's right.
Same thing.
That was kind of a low point for me in my ad career when... I was running BBDO Detroit, and Shelby was doing those cars, you know. And I, you know, let's face it, I have all the respect for the world for what Shelby accomplished, but I was exposed to Shelby, the huckster.
Oh, yeah.
At that point.
And he was a master at it.
Because meaning the agency, was being called on the carpet by him for not pushing his nickel rocket. You know, Dodge.
The GLH.
Yeah, not to offend. Please don't write me, okay? They were fine cars. I call them nickel rockets. That seems to offend all those people. I don't care. Mm-hmm. I mean, the bottom line is here's Shelby trying to put us in a headlock, trying to push his stuff. It's bad.
Well, I hate to hear about
it. Real bad.
I hate to hear about a dilution of AMG because they're still the benchmark that the SVTs of the world, that all these kind of captive tuning groups from other automakers are still shooting for. And if they dilute themselves, what's it going to be?
Well, this isn't the first time Steve Cannon has appeared on the table for doing something stupid. So,
but is this his decision or is this coming out of Germany?
It sounds like a Mercedes-Benz North America deal.
Mm.
It's just like, well, if we put a few things on it, it'll look like an AMG, but you don't have to pay as much. We'll sell more, but it's just like, that goes wrong.
Yeah, but Germany's got to approve it. And, you know, Zetch is under enormous
pressure
right now. Yeah. You better start putting some bucks on the bottom line.
I hate to say it. You know, I got to know Dieter pretty well, and I think he's a good guy, but I think he should have been replaced a few years ago by Wolfgang Bernhard.
Mm-hmm.
He needs to go.
I keep saying I don't think history's going to remember Wolfgang and Dieter fondly in the Daimler Chrysler thing.
And it's too bad because that was Jürgen Schramm's complete... I mean, he is the worst auto executive of all time, Jürgen Schramm, paying $36 billion for Chrysler, and 8 years later, they basically give it to...
Cerberus.
I mean, give it to him.
Right.
It was just like, wow.
Right. Hmm. Speaking of car companies in trouble, looks like Fisker is kaput. I mean...
It's almost stick a knife in it.
Yeah.
Stick a fork in it. Yeah. Yeah. What can you say? Well, I think Lutz's idea to put a Corvette motor in that chassis is still the best thing going, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it'd be cool. I mean, let's face it, it was Henrik's rolling note to self, and he got a lot of people involved. Fortunately, not as bad of a flame-out as DeLorean, but, you know, flame-out nonetheless.
Yeah, we'll see what happens.
He's a gifted designer. Go back to designing.
Sure.
Quit trying to be an auto mogul.
Mm-hmm.
It usually doesn't work well for designers because designers are creative types and they're just, you know.
Yeah.
I just want to put my vision on the road and everyone will buy it. No, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
Well, I keep saying it, you know, he didn't bring anything new to the party. No new technology, you know, whereas Tesla's bringing new technology
to the party. They got the battery. Yeah. Yeah.
And enough so that Daimler and Toyota are licensing them.
Right,
so they've got other money coming in, not just selling the cars.
Right.
They still got a long way to go, though.
They do. They got.
Make no mistake.
We're not crying any tears over Fisker, though, I don't think. You know?
No.
You know, he pretty much, you know, made his bed, and now he's going to flying.
Well, you know, what it's really going to do is, you know, it already has really re-triggered the argument of, you know, what the hell is the government handing out hundreds of millions of dollars to?
Stupid.
They're not vetting these things. These are people who don't know the automotive business.
Right.
They shouldn't be hand. As I keep saying, for research, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, go off with the cockamamie ideas. You never know what's going to work. But don't give them money to run their business.
But you just saw the budget this week, though. There's more money for this. So the gravy train doesn't end with this
stuff.
That's
what happens when you have politicians trying to, you know, first of all, green-tinged politicians trying to be politically correct and try to look like heroes. And they make stupid decisions.
No, they sure have. I mean, you know, I'm very disappointed in what the administration is doing.
Well, it's,
here's an EV program that's not working. Oh, obviously, we're just not spending enough money.
Yeah,
right.
It's the Washington politicians and the Northern California politicians together. A nightmare for the U.S.
Well, it's another reason that, you know, here's this Detroit Electric news, and I just couldn't get out of bed for this thing. You know, so my colleague said, are you going to go down and cover this? No.
I just wanted to go back into the Fisher Building, you know, but I didn't make it either.
You know,
yeah, I don't get it. Where are they going to get their money from? Where are they getting any money from?
Well, it's a good question. Another Lotus Elise platform. It's a good place to start. You got to start somewhere. But where's the money coming from? Where's the plant? Where's
the
development?
What's the
exactly right?
I mean, you know, it's
right.
Too much smoke and mirrors so far.
Right.
Maybe they'll, you know, in a few months, you know, open up and we'll see there's something more substantial. But right now, I don't see it. Yeah. But, you know, they were brilliant in reviving the Detroit Electric name. I got calls from media outlets all over the country. Yeah, tell us, what's this all about?
There's probably an owner's club, too. You know, I can't wait. Only $100,000. This is going to be great. You know?
Right. Hey, what do you make of Mark LaNave getting Lincoln Advertising?
Well, it's kind of, he was already running Team Detroit, and they just added that responsibility to, I mean, the Lincoln agency is in New York. The gentleman that was running it was moved off, and Mark has just added that to his responsibilities. The kind of the release and the media coverage of it kind of blew it way out of...
Made it more than what it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
So. But he, he ran Volvo U.S. in the past. He ran Cadillac in the past.
Well, he was GM CMO for a while.
Oh, yeah, right. So, but what I'm getting at is he's got luxury car experience in his background.
Yeah, well, the real issue for Lincoln right now is on Ford, and that is a production issue. It's not an advertising issue. It's mm-hmm. a get the cars to the dealership right. issue. And they know that.
Right.
And, you know, they spent an awful lot of money on advertising, and some of it was real, really good. Mm. And, you know, it was all premature. They didn't have the dealers at the lots. Now they are. The month of April is the first full month MKZs will be at Lincoln showrooms. So it's a giant we'll see at this point.
Yeah, it's going to be a big deal. I was at a Ford preview for Shanghai today, and Farley was there. I mean, China is, they're just salivating over prospects for a market that really has no experience with Lincoln. I mean, they don't remember suicide doors. They don't remember V12s. Maybe Abraham Lincoln they know,
maybe.
You know, how they're going to make a connection with that, but it's a huge market.
Well, it's also a market that respects history. And Lincoln has a history. And if they mine that over there, they have a chance.
Well, remember what they did at the L.A. show. They brought out all these beautiful, only for media days. In fact, only one media day. They
right.
had these fantastic, a lot of coach work. Lincoln's a lot of one-off. But, boy, if you want to say we've got heritage and we've been around, that mm-hmm. display did it. I would just try to recreate that display in Shanghai.
I would ship all those cars to Shanghai and do the same thing
you bet.
The public.
Right. Well, they didn't own the cars, and that's why it was only shown in media days.
Yeah.
Because the owners of these one-offs were like, no way in hell are we going to let the public paw all over these things.
Yeah.
But to your point, Peter, you're right. I mean, that's why Buick's doing so well, because GM did its homework, and they found out that the last emperor, who was fondly remembered in China, mm-hmm. always drove big Buicks. So they said that's the brand to go with, and it worked brilliantly for them.
Well, and then they'd announce cars over here the last couple of years, and you'd hear this, well, there's more backseat room, you know, because of that market, because there's a lot of people driven around over there. So rear ingress and egress is a premium over there, and I think the Lincoln guys are looking at that. One thing these things can't be, in my mind, is just nice Fords. There's got to be something beyond that.
Well, clearly the Lincoln everyone's waiting for is the next generation MKS going to be the big Lincoln that everybody wants? Everyone expects a Lincoln to be a big Lincoln, and they need that, and they know they need it, and they're working on it. Mm-hmm. So,
did they announce the MKZ going to China and a stretch version of it?
They didn't do that, no.
Okay. I'm only asking because we reported that today on Autoline Daily.
They showed a concept going over, a C-series concept.
That's what the word out of China is.
Right.
It's the Z will be the first one made there, and there will be an extended wheelbase.
I'll tell you what is a disturbing trend, though, is I get the Chinese like their big back seats and everything, but the revision of the Panamera is coming this fall. And they have a long wheelbase Panamera, longer than, you know, admittedly the side profile of a Panamera ain't great.
Right.
So, but they're doing a longer wheelbase version for China. At this point, you know, I put this on a site last week. Let's do a big timeout. Just because you guys want to sell these things in China, don't bring them over here. I mean, just got to be careful. If I'm a manufacturer, say, okay, yeah. We'll do a stretch version because I saw the stretch Panamera and it's just like, oh my God, please don't bring that here. So they got to, you know, they got to edit themselves, which manufacturers are just bad at.
Yeah, they are.
But I'd like to say, you know, do your thing for the Chinese market, but don't automatically assume that that belongs here.
But I know what the thinking is. You know, you invest in all this tooling, and then somebody in finance calls, geez, how do we amortize this even better? And, they get greedy.
Make it longer. Those GMT 360s that, remember, they kind of got crazy. They lengthened that thing. They had the one with the full swoop roof on it. And to your point.
And it looked ridiculous on the road.
In profile, they just looked ridiculous. So you can only stretch things
so far.
Well,
it was an answer to a question nobody asked. Yeah. You know, they said, well, you can put a grandfather clock in the back of
the SUV, that's what they called it. Right. Yeah.
You know. I saw one the other day, and it still looks goofy.
One of the few that were sold.
That's right.
You know.
I mean, the revised Panamera looks good. And and they're working on a coupe version. So
that could be really good.
Yeah.
Lindsay, what do you make of this Ford versus Toyota argument over who sells the best, who has the biggest sales in the world? Corolla versus Focus.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's probably how you slice the thing. I mean, you know, credit to Ford for getting volumes up that high with this. I don't know. They're probably pretty close.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting argument, but that's all it is, an interesting argument.
How about GM pouring more money into Opel?
Better work. It better work.
Yeah. Oh, and I can't wait for the new charm offensive for Captain Puig.
He's on it already.
Oh yeah, no.
Oh, he's on every talk show.
That's the new charm offensive for Captain Puig. So I'll have something to say about it next week.
And who's Captain Puig?
Dan Akerson.
Oh.
But they're pouring $5 billion plus into Opel and. Again, it's almost like we were talking about with the electric car thing. Oh, it's not working. Clearly, we have to spend more money.
Right. Yeah. and in some of those markets, I mean, Chevrolet's doing pretty well. In Russia, Chevrolet, I mean, Chevrolet has a brand resonance in some European. I don't know what Opel's supposed to be in Europe now.
I don't think anybody in Europe knows.
Yeah.
From a consumer standpoint.
Right, exactly right.
Well, it sounds like they don't want to lose their R&D over there. You know.
No, but they got 6 PD centers around the world. Mm-hmm. And China, they're cranking up another one there. They get so much out of Korea right now. I think Opel's cool. I think Opel can be saved. I don't think they're going about the right way of doing it. But I don't know if they need 6 product development centers.
Yeah, I think a lot of that IP came from the Epsilon, which is such a good architecture. Mm-hmm. But moving beyond that, Is it still viable? Is that the reason that you're keeping Opel, is for that?
Well, especially if you're trying to make everything common everywhere in the world,
right?
Then what's special about Opel?
Yeah.
As Opel, You know, just call it GM Europe and get over with. Yeah. You know,
but you think of the union over there. You think of the locality and the politics of this Russelsheim, enormous operation. Europe economy is in the tank right now. What can you say right now? You can't say we're closing this thing. You give it some more life support.
Yeah. Well, you know, I give them credit. They're putting their money where their mouth is. They're saying we're going to stand behind this brand, and $5 billion is that's a big stand.
This is all Gursky. Mm-hmm. This is Gursky. I mean, it's his thing. So,
well, you know, if it works out, he'll be chairman. If it doesn't work out.
No, I don't think so.
You don't think so, huh?
How about the great Sergio says he doesn't need any outside money for Fiat to buy the rest of Chrysler now.
Yeah, but then in the same sentence, he says they still might have to monetize some assets, i.e. sell stuff off.
Yeah, i.e. Dr. Piak on the bat phone. Okay, you win. Buy Alpha from us. I was wrong.
That is such an asset that has been underutilized. And
yeah, but, you know, Sergio's vision for an Alpha that has real volume. That's
right.
That's not Alpha.
Right.
It never was Alpha. It never will be Alpha.
Right.
I mean, Alpha has got such a glorious history, but not as a mass market brand.
Correct.
So, yeah. You know.
And with global architectures, how can you make that work in terms of return on investment? Yeah.
Hey, why don't we take a quick commercial break right now and get our guests, Grant Terry, to come on the show. So, Ben, let's give a shout out to our friends at Bridgestone. Grant Terry, thanks so much for coming on Out of Line After Hours with us.
You're welcome, John. Thanks for inviting me.
So just so the audience knows, you know, we've been promoting that you're from the Eaton Corporation, one of the largest, if not the largest manufacturer of superchargers. But explain a little bit exactly what you do at the company.
Yeah, my role is basically business development. So I'm at the front end of the business, and my job is to go out and talk to the OEMs and
sell superchargers.
Sell superchargers, absolutely. And I've been doing it now for almost 20 years.
So that means you've learned a thing or two along
the way. Just a little bit.
You're an engineer by background?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Engineer. Studied at Brunel University in London, England, and I've been working here in the States since 1996.
You know, I got to tell you, I thought superchargers had lost the war. I thought turbos won. And yeah, there might be some niche areas for superchargers in super high performance, but you guys are proving me wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've done a lot of work to improve our device, and the big breakthrough for us was our Twin Vortices series supercharger, which we launched in 2008.
Which means what, Twin Vortices?
It's basically just a description for the fact that we have two high-twist rotors, and, you know, when they're spinning really fast, it's kind of a vortex effect. When we launched that, it was a step improvement in roots-type technology that really put us on a level playing field from a thermal efficiency standpoint with the turbocharger. So that allowed us to basically compete head-on, not just for performance, but also for fuel economy.
So where are your superchargers right now that the audience would be familiar with?
I guess some of our biggest applications would be with Audi. Audi use our product on the 3-liter engine. It's used in, I think, within the Volkswagen Audi group, 14 or 15 different vehicle applications. And it's actually a very neat application in that we sell just one part number to Audi, and they put it on an engine and basically tune it by changing the calibration of the bypass valve, and they can adapt it to Porsches, the performance vehicles, the S4, the Q7, the big SUV. So they can vary the output by changing the calibration. Jaguar, another big customer of ours, has been on the V8 engine for many years now. But they just launched, a supercharged V6, which is designed to improve fuel economy. It's a downsizing play to replace the V8. So they're two big applications. On the smaller side, we have an application with Nissan on a little 1.2-liter engine that launched in the Micra in Europe just over 12 months ago. And at the end of last year, that launched in Japan on the Nissan Note. And that's proving to be a very, very successful vehicle in Japan.
So, Grant, one of the, within the vehicle community, one of the kind of myths about supercharger versus turbo is the parasitic aspect.
Right.
Is you've got to give up some power to make power. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, the key differences between the devices is that ours is driven by a belt that's connected to the crankshaft, and that takes power from the engine. On the other hand, the turbo, that is in the exhaust flow, and that also has parasitics, but it's used, it's in the form of back pressure on the engine. So that's putting a delta pressure on the engine, trying to, if you will, turn it the opposite direction. So they do have parasitics, but if you look at steady state conditions, a turbo will have a slight edge from a fuel economy standpoint. Where we have the advantage is through transient response.
Instant response.
And the Roots type products still have the industry benchmark for boost response. Typically, we can get to peak manifold pressure in between 200 and 300 milliseconds. I think most turbos today are still in the, you know, 1, 2, 3 second range. And what we do when you look at the complete system, the complete powertrain, is that we can actually downspeed the engine to slow the engine down, get the fuel economy through the reduced frictional and pumping losses, and then maintain good drivability.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, then that's a trend I hear with these guys going to 8, 9, 10-speed transmissions with very small steps between the ratios, is running engines at kind of a constant, very narrow part of the RPM band. And I would think that down-speeding and superchargers would go hand in hand with that trend.
Yeah, that's right. It's a good fit for achieving that goal. The big advantage that we have, of course, is that our transient torque curve is pretty much the same as a steady state torque curve. We don't have the gap to build boost at low speed, and that's why we can leverage downspeeding to get a fuel economy benefit.
That's got to be a great advantage, too, in these very small displacement engines. The 1.2 liter, for example, in the Micra, is that's a small engine, albeit in a small car. But when I got to get out and pass or get out of the way of somebody, I want instant response.
That's right. And that's why Nissan chose supercharging for that application. It's a 1.2 liter. It is a millicycle engine, which also has some advantages for supercharging. But they can basically have the performance of a 1.6 liter, but with the fuel economy of a much smaller engine.
Do you guys have a delta there that you could say, like the turbo guys do, that a 1 liter turbocharged engine has the same basic performance parameter as, say, a 1.5?
Yeah, it's pretty much, you know, it's the same as a turbo. I mean, it's all engine boosting. Mm-hmm. It's producing, you know, a 1 liter engine to perform like a 1.5. Now, the trend is to go towards what we call, you know, extreme downsizing. And as the technology improves, you know, the OEMs have much better control over the combustion process. This is allowing much higher BMEPs at low speeds. Well, that needs very good response from the boosting device to achieve that. And, you know, this aggressive engine downsizing is really pushing the limits of the technology today. But it's an area which we will see a lot of growth in moving forward as the OEMs try and figure out how they're going to hit this 54 miles per gallon by 2025.
Do you have any racing applications at the moment that you?
We do a lot.
All OEM.
The majority of our business today is with the OEMs. However, a very important part of our business is the performance aftermarket. And we have 5 global distributors. I'll name them real quick. We have Magnuson Products and Edelbrock in California. We have Roush right here in Michigan. And then we have Cosworth in England and Harrop Engineering in Australia. And they really work with some of the special either dealer-installed or unique applications. And actually, there is a racing application that's new for the 2013 season on a small Scion vehicle. It's actually Ken Stout's racing team, and he has a I think it's a 2-liter supercharged engine that's racing in the Pirelli World Challenge Series up against the V8 Mustangs and Camaros. So,
when you were mentioning some of your customers, don't you have applications at General Motors?
Yes, today, General Motors have been one of our longtime customers. We go back to the old 3800 supercharged engine that was in the Grand Prix GTP and the SSEI Bonnefils and the Buick Regals. Park Avenue Ultra, great application. And even then, that engine produced pretty good horsepower with good fuel economy. And you were getting 29, 30 miles per gallon out of a 260 horsepower engine from a big car. That was pretty good back in those days. Today, obviously, we have the Corvette LS9, as has our TVS 2300 supercharger. And then the CTS-Vs and the Camaro LS1 has the R1900 TVS supercharger.
The ZL1.
The ZL1. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Stand corrected. Mm-hmm. So GM has been a good customer of ours over the years. We supercharged the Northstar engine. We had the smaller Ecotec that was supercharged for a while. So.
And the TVS system has a really beautiful integration of the intercooling system into this unit, whereas a turbo still has to deal with an intercooler that's kind of separate from plumbing, so to speak.
Yeah, that depends on the application. If it's a V engine, a V6, V8 that has room in the V, you can integrate the supercharger into the intake manifold, include the intercoolers, the throttle bodies, the bypass in one very, very neat package. Four-cylinder engines, it's a little more complex. You have to mount it on the side, but it can still be integrated into the manifold.
What's the cost, turbo versus supercharger?
You know, that's a great question, John. It's something that, I have to say that it's application-specific, and typically speaking, it's pretty much a wash. I mean, there's probably some that are a little bit less in favor of us and vice versa, but on the whole, I think today, with the volumes that we're running, it's a competitive technology.
So what's next for the technology? Is it lighter componentry? Is it more integration? Is it more efficiency?
Well, there's a couple of things that we're doing. The first is to basically continue to improve the base device. And a lot of our focus today is on the smaller superchargers. As downsizing becomes more popular, a lot of our focus is on superchargers that will work on, certainly less than 2 liters, even less than 1 liter engines. To do that, we have to be very cautious about the low speed efficiency. So we're tweaking our rotor profiles and our porting that allow us to improve particularly the low speed volumetric efficiency. That's one key area. The second area is really looking at drive systems. To get the best fuel economy, you really need to put a clutch on the supercharger. Mm. We have an application coming out at the end of this year with a global OEM that will actually have a electromagnetic clutch integrated into the snout of the supercharger.
So when you don't need the power, it's just freewheeling, so to speak?
It's declutched. It's out of the system. So those parasitics that we were talking about earlier, they completely go away. And that now there are some challenges. I mean, it comes down to managing the engagement event and also the durability of the clutch. But, it's production ready now, so we're really excited about that. We're also looking at electric drives. I think the next big thing that you're going to see is being able to drive the supercharger with a very efficient electric motor.
Versus off the crankshaft.
Versus off the crankshaft. And, again, that gives you independent boost supply from engine speed.
You don't have to worry about the clutch wearing out.
That's right. So that's a big area of development right now. A lot of OEMs are really interested in applying that type of technology. We're also looking at multi-speed gearboxes that allow you to run the supercharger very fast at low engine speeds to get those very high BMEPs. And then at high speed, you slow it down and take advantage of improved fuel economy.
Very cool. And currently, a Root supercharger is about 40 to 50% efficient, something like that?
It's a lot more than that today.
It's more than that today? Up to what level?
Right now, we can run up to 75, 76% thermal efficiency.
And what you're talking about, adding motors and clutches and so forth, can you get up higher than that?
I think looking at what is feasible is, we've done some studies and we recognize that we can probably get theoretically another 10% out of it, but it's a challenge to do that. We're looking at different materials, different coatings to try and achieve that. But it is feasible that we can squeak some more out of it now.
Very cool.
You mentioned, what'd you call it, like hyper-aggressive downsizing. Are you referring to like this two-cylinder engine Fiat's got, the three-cylinder that Ford's got, 1 liter or less displacement?
Well, I think it's, you know, instead of replacing a 1.6 with a 1 liter, you're replacing a 2 liter with a 1 liter. That drives very, very high BMEPs. And there's a lot of activity right now looking at the best way to do that. And one of the trends that we're seeing is the combination of a supercharger and a turbocharger, where you take advantage of the supercharger for its response, and then you size the turbo for the high speed, high power to get good fuel economy.
Which Volkswagen's already done, right?
That's right. So that's exactly right. And you're going to see a lot more of that type of product in the marketplace.
You guys don't have the underhood heat issues that a turbocharging system has. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
So for smaller vehicles, for smaller engine compartments, that's all a good thing. You've got less heat shielding, et cetera.
Right. It's definitely an advantage that you can control the thermal issues under the hood.
And your positive displacement, so you're not creating heat by compressing the air.
Yeah, that's a good point. All of our products are based on the roots type positive displacement theory. We don't have internal compression. We have the industry benchmark boost response, as I said before. So really, it's really a good fit.
So do you guys use the term blower around the shop?
Yeah, we do. Yeah. Yeah.
What's the advantage to going with a supercharger combined with a turbocharger? Because we see so many other engines that are twin turbo. Why not just do that?
Well, you still have issues with response. And if you look at putting these heavily downsized engines into larger, heavier vehicles, that response becomes a bigger problem. So you'll feel it more in those heavy vehicles. A good example is Nissan are just launching a four-cylinder supercharged hybrid that they're putting in their large, you know, seven-seat crossover vehicles. And they chose the supercharger to maintain good response from that vehicle. The super turbo combination allows you to get that response and not sacrifice performance for fuel economy. You can have both.
But I would have thought in a hybrid, you just put a bigger electric motor in there to get the boost. What's the advantage of putting a supercharger on the engine?
Well, I think the goal is to downsize. I mean, it's if you're using a four-cylinder boosted in place of a V6, the supercharger is not going to be boosting the whole time, and that's where you get your fuel economy advantage from. And then they're using the electric motor as an assist for the powertrain to help with the launch and get some regeneration and help with the overall efficiency of the package.
Geez, from the Micra to the Pathfinder, sounds like Nissan's turning into a good customer for superchargers.
That's right. Absolutely.
Do you see regional variations? I mean, are some parts of the world more pro-turbo than supercharger? Is that changing?
I think, you know, historically, I'd say that Europe has probably been very, very pro-turbo, but I think it's changing. If you look at Audi, they're a boosting company. They use both products very, very successfully. And I think you'll see more of that. I think that as the OEMs look for the technical solutions to meet these stringent fuel economy and emissions, you're going to see a mix of all types of devices and technologies to do that. So I think there's a place for supercharging and turbocharging. You'll see customers that will use one or the other or a combination of both. So I think it's a trend. The boosting trend is coming and it's here to stay.
Grant, as you look at 95 grams of CO2 per kilometer in Europe, very, very stringent, 54.5 mpg over here. Do you see a time when naturally aspirated engines just won't be around anymore in volume?
That's a good question. I think that the percentage of boosting engines is definitely growing. I think I'm trying to think of the numbers here, but I think it's basically in the next 4 or 5 years, it's going to double. I think today we're at about 10 million gasoline boosted engines, and that's going to grow to about 20 million by the 2018-2019 timeframe. So I think there's definitely a trend. Will it completely eliminate natural gas? I probably not, just from a cost standpoint. Mm.
I don't know that you can even buy a naturally aspirated diesel in light vehicles anymore, at least in this country.
No, I think that's true. I think the majority of diesel engines today are turbocharged. That's a big opportunity for us.
That's what I was going to ask you. Why no superchargers on diesels?
Well, previously we didn't have the technology that could compete. I mean, our previous generation supercharger prior to TVS was only capable of 2.0 pressure ratio, and it ran about 64-65% peak thermal efficiency. With the advent of TVS, we're now a viable alternative for diesel engines.
And just for the audience again, explain TVS. What's that all about?
The main feature of TVS was adding a much higher helix angle on the rotors.
So instead of just straight cut lobes, you sort of put a twist in them.
Yeah, the Eaton design has always been based on what we call a modified roots, which is putting a twist on the rotors. Our original design was based on a three lobe 60 degree twist. This has evolved into our TVS, which is four lobe, 160 degree twist. And this allows for a much more efficient air fill of the supercharger.
And aren't these lobes Teflon coated too? Isn't it some low friction thing that you've got?
No, that's not on our device. I think that the Teflon coating comes from the top fuel dragsters that use tips to get the best sealing. But we actually use an abradable coating on our rotors, and this allows us to basically optimize the clearances inside each supercharger individually and maintain very, very good efficiency.
So this 160-degree twist, you're just essentially pushing more air through the same volume or same size as supercharger.
That's correct. We have a much more efficient airflow. We can put a bigger inlet on the supercharger, and for each revolution, we can get more air into the device.
So anyway, TVS, all of a sudden now that opens up the diesel market for you.
Right. And one of the big advantages that you have with a supercharger is that because we're not connected into the exhaust stream, we can actually pump EGR during transients. And by doing that, you can actually reduce the particulate matter that's produced from smoke. We can maintain that air-fuel ratio during those transient events. Helps with NOx. Helps with response. It has a lot of benefits on diesels. And we have a lot of OEMs that are evaluating using a supercharger on their next generation diesel engines.
You know, it's amazing to me to see the automakers over the last few years have gone out and encouraged other suppliers to get into the turbo business. So in addition to Garrett, which is owned by Honeywell, and BorgWarner, now we're seeing, Continental? Isn't Bosch? Bosch and Mahle?
Bosch and Mahle have a 50-50 deal, yeah.
So who else makes superchargers? Do you guys have the light vehicle market to yourselves?
Pretty much, yeah.
What a position to be in.
Yeah, we have a lot of the OEMs don't like that, but...
Watch it. They're going to encourage somebody to come in and compete.
I think as the technology evolves, I think we'll see more players in the market. Today, we probably have between 90 and 95% of the OE business for superchargers.
Wow.
And our business is growing. I mean, we've doubled in size. Our revenue doubled in the last 2 years, and we're going to double again in the next 2 or 3 years. So it's definitely a growth area for us, and it's very exciting times to be involved in engine boosting.
You guys adding resources in terms of engineering and R&D
for this
area? Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, we added a lot of engineers last year. We're adding a few this year. It's trying to keep up with the interest from the OEMs as they try and find out what is the solution to meet this 54 miles per gallon fuel economy. We have product on test with the majority of the OEMs in their advanced research labs as they try and figure out how they're going to do it. Mm. It's going to take technology to get there. So,
any noise issues with this? I remember early superchargers that always be kind of you'd hear the belts turning, you'd hear some lobe issues.
Yeah, I think the TVS design actually really helped improve the NVH of the product. It's typically application specific. As with any boosted engine, you're going to have to put some abatement treatment on there to help tune out some of the noise. If you drive a Cadillac today, you drive a Jaguar or an Audi, I mean, you can't hear the supercharger.
No, that's absolutely true.
It's
you do not hear it.
So.
That might actually be a good thing. I mean, here people paid for all this boost. You want to hear it.
I think the guys in the performance aftermarket, if they pay, $10,000 to put a blur on their Mustang, they want to hear it.
So. That's right.
Well, ZL1 Camaro, the same thing. When I take my son for rides in those cars, I say, tune in everything, listen to everything, because these things aren't going to be around forever. And the kind of brawny mechanical aspects of a blown engine is just a wonderful thing.
That's right. But I think they will be around forever. I think they'll certainly be around in our lifetime. I think there's going to be always a demand out there for performance vehicles, and there's nothing better than right. using a supercharger.
Mm-hmm. And they might be running on liquid propane anyway, so they'll be around for a long time.
We can do that.
Hey, we got a bunch of questions coming in from the audience.
Okay.
Why don't we get to the rapid fire part of the show? So, Ben, let it rip. Okay, first question that we've got here is, and Eric, I'm going to butcher your name. I do it every time, but it's Ambrioska, which is something like that. He says, turbo versus supercharger. What's the number one consideration, price or packaging?
I would say that, good question. I would say that probably, packaging is one of the key things that OEMs look at.
It's got to fit. Then you can argue over the price.
That's right. That's right. I think the pricing, I feel that we can be competitive for equivalent volumes with turbo. So packaging can be a make or break for either technology.
He says, can you debate centrifugal versus screw?
I'll debate centrifugal versus roots. The screw-type supercharger has the internal compression. Our TVS can basically hit those same efficiency levels without having to have the added parasitic of the internal compression. The advantage that we have over the centrifugal is that we can deliver the airflow immediately at low speeds. A centrifugal has to be spinning at very high speed to deliver the boost. So we still have a transient response advantage over a centrifugal supercharger.
There you go, Eric. Peter, I'm going to throw this one to you. Joseph N. wants to know, you were talking about Alfa Romeo as a mass market brand. What about the dealers? Fiat said Alfas in America will sell through Fiat 500 dealers, but might also be available through Chrysler dealers. Isn't that a slap at the Fiat dealers who have been starved for product?
Well, yes, but, that was the big deal with Sergio. He got the dealers together and sold them. He demanded they spend money and demanded standalone showrooms, and he promised them all of these Alfa products by 2014 for them to sign up. Ain't happening. So, yeah, you got some very disappointed dealers out there.
Okay, Abhi wants to know, does anyone know the first or early car company that already had small engines with a turbo that we're seeing so much these days? He says, I can think of Volvos and Saabs. They had turbos in pretty much all of their model lineup.
I can. GM V8 had a turbo.
62.
Skylark, right?
Yeah.
Early Corvairs had a turbo option in 64. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I want to say there were Paxton turbos on Studebakers in the 50s, I want to say.
They were superchargers.
Superchargers.
Yeah.
Actually, some of the early Bentleys back in the... Bentleys,
the
right?
The Blower Bentleys.
Sure, absolutely. Beautiful cars. I think even late 20s they
Auburn had a supercharged car. They had supercharged nameplate on the side.
Yeah, the Blower Bentleys won Le Mans.
Right.
Yeah, and I think there were some Bugattis as well that were along with the supercharger.
And Mercedes had blowers way back.
I think first use of supercharging or a roots type was in foundry work, wasn't it? Supplying blast furnaces?
And also the and fighters in World War II.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the original roots pump was invented for basically pumping fresh air into a mine. I think that's where the technology came from. And somebody had the bright idea to put it on an engine and push more air in and make more power.
And Don Garlitz came right after that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Flash to Pass wants to know, can an Eaton supercharger boost the eco motors or the eco motors opposed engine, the OPOC engine?
Actually, that's a great question. I was listening to your conversations earlier. The key thing about those opposed piston engines is they're two-stroke. And what that means is that they need a positive displacement device to scavenge the cylinders.
Right.
So maybe that's a good question for you to ask your guests next week.
2 weeks.
In 2 weeks. But those concepts do require a supercharger. So.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Hey, we got a phone call here. Ben, let's bring that in.
Yeah, this is Clem Zorowski in Delmont, Pennsylvania. On the turbocharger, supercharger business, isn't the big advantage of these is that the manufacturers could run a much smaller engine to help them get past the emissions because that they how they test the emissions, the turbocharger, superchargers don't even come in. I would like to know if that's the truth. Thank you very much.
Good question.
That's a good question.
Do they kick in during the EPA test cycle?
I think it depends on the application. I mean, obviously, the whole goal here is to downsize the engine and run it in a naturally aspirated mode for as long as possible. And I think on some of the cycles, the boosting device is not engaged, and that does help with the fuel economy.
You know, I know in talking to a lot of people who are leery of turbochargers, they think, oh, it's going to burn up the oil and... there's other issues like that. There doesn't seem to be that perception problem with superchargers.
No, I think we've done a good job. I mean, we have a self-contained lubrication system. They're basically sealed for life. They require no service. So we've done a good job over the years to improve the durability. And really, it's a non-event for us these days. It's a very reliable component.
Okay, Peter, here's another good one for you from VRM Chris. He says, what is Mercedes really about? What's their unique selling proposition?
Well, I think their big problem is they've lost it. You know, for years and years, they were engineered like no other cars in the world in the U.S. It was one of the great ad teams. And then they decided they'd become more approachable to the market. They were too stuffy and they were too blah, blah, blah. And the minute they did that, they lost their way. So they have a vast product lineup, and you can cherry pick the really good stuff, but the rest of it is just like, So that's how important image wrangling is in this business.
Don't you think they're in danger as they go down market of diluting the brand?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they did it with the, they did it before, and now they're going to do it again with the A-Class, which, you know, they've got an AMG A-Class coming, and who knows? I mean, the base Mercedes A-Class will be $30,000.
I wonder if this is all because the Smart brand was such a fiasco. That was supposed to be their down brand market, and it's been a disaster.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think they want to compete against Audi and BMW. And the German sit-arounds, you know, they get all wacky when they think the competition's doing something. Then they go off and do it, and who knows about Mercedes? I just think they're just flopping and flipping and meandering around. You know, this car is good, but don't look at that car that close. And yeah, what does Mercedes stand for? I don't know.
Now the three-pointed star.
Yeah, now it's the best or nothing, which was Gottlieb Daimler's, you know, he founded the company, a motto. And that, to me, that holds up next to engineered like no other car. But they're going to have to hammer that home a long way. And the just looking at the A-Class doesn't seem like the best or nothing to me.
Mm. Nick Bridges wants to know here, we see more and more Miller cycle and Atkinson cycle engines often paired with supercharging. He wants to know if these variations are more efficient, why don't we see more automakers adopting it?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think that it's coming. I think you're going to see more of this as OEMs look at different combustion technologies to meet their fuel economy goals. You're going to see a mix of everything, and Miller Cycle is one of the things that can deliver that.
Stephen Cutney wants to know, in turbos versus superchargers, does one or the other, are they better suited to flex fuel vehicles or dual fuel vehicles?
I think they both work equally as well with flex fuel. That's not really an issue. It comes down to the calibration of the engine.
Let's see.
Especially if your flex fuel is nitrous oxide in the trunk.
Why can't I get that at the pump? Lindsay, here's a good one for you. What do you make about Tesla and their earnings? You know, they finally reported a first quarter earning. Joseph N. wants to know, is this for real?
Well, I don't know. I visited the plant back in late November, and, you know, that plant is just monstrous, you know, the old NUMMI plant. And they have a small line, almost a craft shop kind of build. The big question is with those guys is bringing the second model on stream and how they can cope with that. I think their volume right now, I think they've done 2,000 Model S's, something like that.
No, I think they're claiming they sold 4,500 cars in the first 3 months of the year.
Okay, so they're beating maybe their analysts, maybe their own expectations were kind of intentionally lower than they could have been.
Kind of an
old Japanese industry trick in that regard. But, you know, how they're going to fill that plan, how they're going to build the second model, which if it's anything like it was at the Detroit show with gullwing doors and so forth, how are they going to get the cost out of something like that? I don't know. I mean, you know, like we talked earlier, they've got a technology that, say, Fisker doesn't have. They've got batteries, Mercedes collaboration, Toyota collaboration with them. I think the jury's still out, really. I mean, my own feeling is that Elon Musk's heart is in SpaceX.
Yeah.
That's the feeling.
I agree with you.
And who wants to fight it out in the knife fight that is the global auto industry when you've got 100% of delivery devices up into space?
The final frontier,
yeah,
baby.
Exactly right. And so who knows what his end game is? I mean, is it to sell it to Toyota or Mercedes? Is it sell it to the Chinese? I don't know.
I think that is his end game.
I think that's his end game.
And, yeah. You know, I think you raise a really good point. They're profitable, and I think their earnings are right. And, look, Tesla has really impressed me. But now they've got to go out and raise another $1 billion for this next, you know, lineup of vehicles that they've got to bring out. So I haven't seen the numbers. I'm going to have to go look at that. When they say they're profitable, how profitable is profitable? I mean, is it a penny profit or is it a $100 million profit?
Yeah, and there, when you go to that plant, I mean, they're not running. You watch the body line, which is really almost one guy kind of pushing a semi-finished body in white down to the next station. It's not running 60 jobs, you know. It doesn't have the urgency that a real assembly plant has. It has a real craft shop kind of feel. And there's zones in that plant they call the dark zones because it's just everything that was there when GM and Toyota were there. It's kind of like outer space. So only part of the plant is lit right now. You know, so who knows?
Like 15% of the plant or something?
Exactly right, yeah.
Well, I was out to the old NUMMI plant. That place was gigantic. Remember, they were making over 400,000 vehicles a year there in its heyday,
yeah,
with between Toyota and GM. It's actually two separate plants. And I just think it's a big PR move that they moved into the old Toyota facility to make it sound like, oh, NUMMI's reopened. Well, a very small sliver of NUMMI has reopened.
I think, don't get me wrong, I think Model S is a great first effort. I mean, the level of refinement they got, the performance they got. I mean, I was a big skeptic on these battery packs with the form factor and 6,800 cells and so forth, but They've made it work so far. I think it's a good-looking car. I love the big screen in it, you know.
I'm impressed.
Just don't try driving it from, you know, New York to wherever that guy tried driving it, you know. So,
Peter, here's another one for you from No Agenda. He said, what would you suggest is the best car to plan on buying once one reaches the empty nest stage of life? I'm thinking Cayman. Yay or nay?
If you're into Porsches, the Cayman is the thinking person's 911. It's smaller, it's more agile. The new 911 I love, but it's a bigger car. I think the Cayman is day in, day out the best sports car you can buy in the U.S.
I think it looks better than the 911 myself.
Yeah.
Especially from the rear three quarters mm-hmm. view. I think mm-hmm. it's just one of the best looking Porsches ever.
Yeah. And what's the cheapest Cayman now? I mean, the one I sat in at the New York show was over $100,000.
Well, yeah, but that's the legendary Porsche option list.
Right.
I mean, if you're really serious, you can get a Cayman or a Cayman S with not too much stuff on it and pay under $65,000 or $68,000 for an S. But most dealers have S's that are $75,000, $80,000.
They know they can get it, so they're going to tack it on. No Agenda also says, is Tesla poised to break through with their funky lease deal? Can you explain it in layman's terms? No.
No, we don't have enough time on this show.
Not even the people at Tesla can explain it in layman's terms. It's just not possible.
It's smoke and mirrors, but... Well.
And now Musk is talking about maybe building cars in Texas to get around the whole dealer franchise thing down there. Did you hear that today?
Yeah, it's just
crazy.
That's not gonna happen.
Crazy.
Yeah, what? Final assembly. The bolt the wheels on, and that's Texas.
They can buy Toyota's pickup truck plant from them down there. That's
the last thing Tesla needs is another plant of any kind.
That's right.
Okay, and we're going to end up on you here, Grant. This will be the last one. AM2 wants to know, what's the future for superchargers for non-premium cars?
Well,
maybe that Micra explains it all,
I think the Micra is a good example. I think you're going to continue to see more of that small engine, you know, with multiple boosting devices. I think that's where we're heading globally. I think it's going to come to the U.S. eventually. I think engines and cars have been getting smaller over here, so I think that trend will continue. So I think look for a combination of boosting devices. There'll be supercharger only. There'll be some turbo, but it's going to be a mix of everything. I think there'll be some differentiation, and there'll be some consumer choice.
I can't wait to see this little micro-sized supercharger. That's got to be like a little gem of a piece of machinery.
It's a small one. Yeah, I actually have one in the car, so when the show gets done,
I'll
show it.
Yeah, no,
about the size of this?
It's a little bit longer, but yeah.
Anyway, Grant Terry, thanks so much for coming on Autoline After Hours. Great discussion on supercharging.
I appreciate it. Thanks for inviting me, and hopefully we'll be invited back at some point.
You bet. Lindsay Brook, great having you here, man.
Same here. Thanks, really John. Good. Thanks really so good. Much.
And always good seeing you, Peter.
Yes, John.
So we want to remind everybody who watches the show live, next week it's going to be at 3:30 p.m. Eastern time. And we're going to have David Johnson, the CEO of Acades. You pronounced it differently. Acates or?
I thought it was Acades.
Acades?
It's Acades.
Acades? Okay.
There you go.
Thank you.
And don't worry, we'll rerun the show at its normal time and have the podcast at its normal time. But anyway, thanks for having tuned in, folks.
And John, we have one last parting call.
Oh.
A comment on the show. I'll just play that real quick.
Okay, do that.
Hey guys, this is Youngblood, Cleveland, Ohio calling. I'd like to sum up my opinion of your show. Super! Rounds for everybody, Barkeep. Bye. Later.
Thanks, Youngblood.
Thanks, Youngblood.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.